Chapter 11. Giles found that late morning Manhattan was a different animal to rush hour Manhattan. The news hounds either had not bothered to dig up the location of their hotel or had not yet managed to purchase that information. So the sidewalk outside the lobby was about as busy as any other stretch of sidewalk in the immediate area, which was not that much. People passed by on foot at an easy pace with comfortable buffers of space surrounding them, many engaged in private conversations. Some of them walked alone, and the other end of that conversation was an invisible entity, maybe human or maybe not. Even so, he was glad he had remembered to grab a hat and sunglasses on the way out. Most of the drones whizzing by overhead were engaged in some form of delivery service, bike messengers having gone extinct within the confines of the city. But Giles was ever aware of the smaller, slower-moving units. The only job they had was to watch. Manhattan was much smaller than he had imagined. When Anna told him they could walk from one side to the other, from the Hudson to the East River, in about 20 minutes, he was convinced she pulled his leg. Then she proved it, and when he stood against the railing with Pier 81 on his right and the ferry terminal on his left, he shook his head at the impenetrable murk of the water below and laughed. She asked him why he did, and smiling, he said that all the movies had convinced him the place stretched on forever. She smiled and would have told him that doing the job lengthwise was another thing altogether, but his laughter made her happy the way a coughing fit makes you happy when it passes by without turning into something worse, like a heart attack. She walked him through Times Square and showed him all the things she had discovered the previous day while alone, pretending to see all of the wonders it held for the first time right along with him. They stood together holding hands on the sidewalk, heads craned up at the jumbled wall of smiling faces, exploding colors and spinning products. It all stretched impossibly above them, the smallest presentation measuring 80 feet from corner to corner, entrapping them in a deformed circle like the walls of a crumbling digital coliseum. He pointed at a narrow building that stretched so high as to challenge the dominion of the clouds, where a giant's hand upended a can of Coke as large as a city bus, over and over and over again. The deep brown liquid spilled down and down the side of the building, where it was caught at the bottom by a tall glass, perfect in every way. The size of the building made that glass look about normal to Giles, but he knew it was probably bigger than the house they lived in back home. He was stricken by the silence of that place at that specific time. Foot and motorized traffic seemed minimal to him, though the only frame of reference he had was the morning rush, and he had not seen Times Square in a rush. He supposed it must get pretty loud during those periods. Now they were surrounded by a calmness that seemed unnatural in all that hugeness and bright motion, the easy sough of passing car tires, the occasional rattle of an old combustion engine, the insistent warning alarm of reversing construction equipment, and the silence of people enclosed within the bubble of their own universe as they passed, their only sound the knocking of heels on pavement. He wondered why he always thought this place must sound like the rushing roar of a filled stadium no matter the time of day. He wondered why it felt so close and wrong. Anna saw the expression in his eyes after a while and knew what it meant. She was still in the process of learning why some things impacted him as they did, but she had loved him long enough to understand these things sometimes did occur. She pulled gently at his hand, and he smiled at her a moment after, and she knew it was all right again. She said, "Let's head up Broadway a while. There's something in that direction I want you to see." "More giant signs?" he asked. "No, something quite different." "Good." They walked for what seemed a long time through a canyon of buildings, picking their way from sidewalk to sidewalk at the chirping command of crosswalk lights, dodging under and around scaffolding. After 4 blocks, Giles was puffing for breath, and the color he felt in his cheeks was pleasant and invigorating. He called out to ask, as Anna had ranged a few yards ahead, if there was always construction everywhere. She hollered back that she thought there was. He said little after that, concentrating instead on his breathing. Sometimes he concentrated on the vigorous swing of her hips as she walked ahead of him, and smiled unconsciously. The canyon opened up eventually on a roundabout, and here the cars seemed more numerous, running by in a constant stream like blood cells through an artery. He still felt the sentinel buildings looming over him, weighing down upon his shoulders and neck to scrutinize. But he also felt as if he had a chance of escaping them. There was more open sky overhead than he would have hoped for to the east, with chariots of cloud galloping along treetops. He felt his heart pulled toward them, and a moment later, Anna took up his hand again and pulled in the direction of his heart. They passed a golden goddess poised either for war or peace astride three frothing, handsome horses, and Giles despaired of ever learning her name as they plunged headlong into the trees. They left the box canyons of concrete and glass behind in the other world. A canopy closed in overhead, bathing them in a green glow like light through colored glass, and he saw that the sky and the clouds were hidden above it. She took him down a wide paved avenue, walled on either side with low iron fences. Park benches dotted the way. Sometimes they held people. People passed them by as well, moving in different directions. He saw people on bicycles, and sometimes on scooters. They all looked unconcerned, engaged in their own private thoughts. Giles liked that about them. His hand sometimes slipped from Anna's as they strolled along, but always found its way back, like exhausted lovers in bed occasionally coming around for another kiss. He felt the pulse of her heart through her thumb, and it was warm and good, like the day around him, and the pavement beneath his feet did not jar with each step, and the temperature was perfect under the canopy, with the slow, sweet breeze, and he began to remember happiness. She took him to the center of a large grass field, opened wide under the yawning sky. The trees were now far away at the edges, and beyond them, the buildings looking over their tops. But the buildings were even further than the trees, and did not bother him so much. There were many people sharing the field with them, huddled together in their own groups or lounging alone, dotting the landscape. Annalise led him to a wide patch of empty green and made him lay down on his back. It was damp, and he could feel it beginning to seep into his clothes, but then she sat down, crossed her legs, and laid his head upon her calves. Then he could see only clouds and sky and her, and everything else surrounding them disappeared from the world. She gave him a few minutes' worth of silence, and then asked, "Better now?" He closed his eyes to concentrate on the warmth, and nodded. She gave him some more time. He was not sure how much, but he soon realized he was beginning to drift off when she spoke again. "What now?" He cracked his eyes open to look up at her. Her face was another sun. "They won't find anything besides my notes. They'll have to let me back in after this is all done. You're quite sure? You haven't spoken to anyone?" She shook her head, and wisps of burnished gold brushed his face. "Something leaked out somehow," he muttered. "Are they investigating their own as hard as you?" "Yes," he said. "I don't imagine it'll be very popular, though." "Good," she spat. "What?" Another tickle of hair over his face. "Because someone in there did this, and now this is happening to you. Whoever it is, I want them to lose their job over it." He reached up and found her hand. The pulse was still within her thumb, and he smiled. "Assume you get back in," she continued. "What then?" Giles sighed and shrugged. Damp points of fabric pulled away from his shoulders and chilled him. "This was much easier when nobody knew what we were doing. Only a small group of people to review my findings. Let them vet it all, and if it turned out later that I got it right, I could have published a paper, maybe even written a book a few years down the line. Now everyone knows. They'll be waiting for me. They'll be waiting for what I determine. The whole world, or as much of the world as matters. If I get it wrong, I'll never hear the end of it. Never get away from it. I see it coming already. Suppose I come out and say that Cronus is. The story is out there now. That finding will rip across the internet. It'll snowball and explode and become something terrible. And then after that, after they review my findings, suppose they decide I was wrong. My name will become a punchline." Her hand had begun to stroke his forehead as he spoke. He was aware of it in a pleasant way, but the feeling dulled the more he spoke. "And suppose it is conscious and I say it's not. There may or may not still be a review after that, but what if none of us get it right, and it's aware the way it is, and knows it must continue to perform or be terminated?" "But what if you say he's aware and you get it right?" Anna asked. Giles shrugged. "I don't know. Maybe worse. It seems to be that no matter how many people are out there, No matter how many of them you manage to please, there are always an equal number screaming for your head. Who can say? But who could possibly have a problem with that? As I said, I don't know. I'm sure someone will find a way, though. Let's leave, Giles. Tonight. Call up Reggie. Let him know. The situation has become impossible and you just want out. He'll understand. After everything that's happened with Guardian, you know he will. I can't, he sighed. Why? Because I can't walk away. I have to know, Anna. You don't. Yes, I do. I can't leave it. She looked away, and he felt the full force of the sun spear into his face. His eyes had been closed, but the energy of that distant star bore through his lids, and the whole world screamed in red. He draped a forearm across his brow. You're mad at me, he said. No, I knew who you were when I married you, but sometimes I wonder. About? I wonder what you love more. Me? Or the puzzle? What puzzle? He asked. Whatever puzzle you happen to be working on. You. Always you. I wonder. Her voice trailed off. He looked up at her, fighting against the bitter rays of the sun, and found her face somewhere far away. He took her cheek in hand and said, Always you. But you won't leave tonight. Anna. What? What if it is? She said nothing in response. He pulled his hand away. She caught it, kissed it, and then rested it down upon his chest. They became quiet again and waited until the sun moved to a place where it was not so punishing. He felt the coolness of shifting shadows and heard her ask, Do you know how you'll do it? No, he said simply. The best I have is to build up enough evidence pointing in one direction or the other, enough of it that I'm convinced, so that I can then try to convince others. Well, how would you do that with a human? A human? Yes. You said to me that the problem is the same for a computer as it is for a human, right? So that means if someone asked you to prove that a human was conscious, you'd be having just as much trouble. He thought over this a moment, scratching idly at his ribs. That's not quite right. I'm a human, too. Everyone reviewing my results would be human. There would be a bias in the direction of a positive finding. If we found in the negative, it would mean we'd have to start asking questions about the validity of our own awareness. It would be in our best interests to state that the subject was aware. And it's not in your best interests to find that a computer is aware because it's different? Well, strictly speaking, yes. He felt her shift under his head, so he sat up to let her move around. She thanked him, stretched out her feet, and began slapping lightly at her shins. Explain why that is, she said. Easy. Please name for me a species that challenges humankind for primacy over this planet. She took a moment to answer, and he saw from the expression of her face that she had been momentarily thrown. I can't think of any. Yes, he agreed. That is because we have killed them all. She thought on this as well and said, You're saying the computers become killer robots? He smiled and worked hard not to laugh at this. No, I should think that unlikely. All I'm saying is that when we collectively identify competition, we tend, historically speaking, to treat that competition rather harshly. Along that line of reasoning, finding that Cronus is just a computer is desirable, both for its safety and our psychic well-being as a species. She slumped over her knees as she considered this. While he waited for her to respond, he began to pull individual blades of grass from the ground and split them carefully down the middle. Do you think you'd do that? She finally asked. Give a wrong answer on purpose? I do not know, he said. She shook her head and looked off at two children tossing a frisbee between each other. Her eyes were wide and unsettled. He wanted to say something but could not think of what that might be. Finally, she said, Okay, let's forget that for now. Assume you don't have to worry about it. Let's pretend you have two subjects, a human and Cronus. They both have the same voice, and they're locked in separate rooms, so you can't see them, and you have to do the job on both of them, determine whether they're conscious or not. How would you do that? He smiled broadly at this and said, Maybe you should have been a scientist. She smiled back uncertainly and shook her head. You basically just described the Turing test. No, she said. That's not how it goes. Is it? Basically, yes, it's the same thing. The theory is that you lock the computer and the human away in different rooms, just like you said, and talk to them both for some period of time. If at the end of the test, you can't tell which subject is human and which is machine, the machine is said to have passed, and therefore must be considered truly intelligent. Anna scoffed and said, Maybe I'd better ask for a raise. I always thought it was different, like an SAT test or something that you gave to the computer. Giles smiled and said, Not quite. Well, fine then, I've given you the setup. Now, Mr. Doctor, how do you run your test? Something medical? Medical, he whispered thoughtfully. Assume a patient was in a deep coma, she said. What kind of test would you run to see if he was a vegetable? Well, there are a number of simple tests you'd run, many reflexive. One way is to squirt some ice water into the ear canal and see how his eyes track. But if you're looking for a specific device to measure brain activity, that's just an EEG. Okay, she nodded excitedly. Can you use an EEG on Cronus? Giles shook his head. An EEG just measures electrical activity in the brain, babe. The part of Cronus that makes him work is all electrical signals and lights. The EEG would probably have a fit, assuming I could figure out where to connect the damn thing. But is there something you could use that's like an EEG for a computer? Some sort of device that gives you a hard number that you could point to and say, Here, look at this. This says there's more going on than just basic circuitry. He thought about her question before he was forced to shake his head yet again. I can't think of a single thing. I doubt such a thing has even been considered. But don't feel bad, you're asking all the right questions. It's just that we're back to the fundamental problem. Nobody really understands what consciousness actually is. The way we detect its existence in humans is pathetic. Really, squirting water in people's ears and measuring neurological activity is about as far as anyone's gotten. I can't believe that's all we figured out, she groused. Everything else that's been achieved, and in this one area, nobody's even tried? It's so basic. Maybe someone has figured something out, but I sure haven't heard of it. I'd have to get on the internet and start digging around. It was as though he had uttered magic words. She looked at him sharply, shrugged, and stood fluidly from the ground. He took a moment to admire her grace, and then asked, What's up? She held her hand out to him. Lunch. After that, back to our room. You've got some homework to do, buddy. Homework? You just said it yourself. You need to start doing some research. You're sure as hell not accomplishing that out in the middle of this field. She grabbed onto his hand and hauled him up. He followed her obediently as she led the way to the nearest walking path. He was used to her focus, the kind that bubbled up to the forefront when a plan of attack was clear. At times, it was all he could do to hold on. He spent the rest of the afternoon lost in Anna's tablet searching down digital back alleys for any reasonable method he could cannibalize for his purposes. He had fallen back to generalized queries when his initial attempts failed. The first thing Giles had tapped into the screen was the pointed question, How can you tell if a computer has become self-aware? The results this simple question produced were dubious, as he had known they would be. Apart from the various selection of science fiction material, the primary yield consisted of articles positing how a self-aware computer might be constructed, how it might behave if it were possible that such a thing could exist, the earliest date at which it might exist, and numerous items unhelpfully discussing the current state of technology and its relation to the now outdated Turing test. He had known the question for a pointless one before submitting it, and yet he felt it had to be attempted, if only for the ability to say he had tried if anyone asked. He began to look into the latest developments in medicine for inspiration. During this line of inquiry, he found an article detailing a new metric defining the point at which a human could be considered truly conscious. He was excited at this discovery, noting that a hard number had been defined, but then read further and realized it was no good at all. The greatest applicability for the technique was to the field of anesthesiology, in which the practitioner must determine a patient sufficiently under before allowing the surgeon to apply a knife. In other words, the measurement was only for a being already known to possess consciousness, rather than some system altogether unknown from the outset. Additionally, the measurement required the use of an electroencephalogram, a device so rudimentary in function that the thought of even trying to apply it to Cronus inspired Giles to exhausted giggles. Where, he wondered, would the electrodes be connected? Directly to a PCB? Or perhaps a server case somewhere? He continued to search, finding nothing else as promising as the EEG article, and when he glanced out the window to see the darkening sky, he fell back into the couch and rubbed his eyes. He heard the low drone of the TV in the bedroom, and considered going back there to crawl in alongside Annalise, lying to himself that he only required a bit of rest. He tapped a few more links to prove to himself this was so, and then found something new. He found something quite new. An old video posted sometime within the last 5 years by a man named Peter Nowak. Giles watched the video for a few minutes, scoffed, and nearly backed out of it on the basis of its absurdity alone. He happened to glance at the progress bar before doing so, finger hovering over screen, and decided on a whim to watch through to the end. He could use the amusement. As the video progressed, he became less amused. Further, he began to feel uncomfortable as it neared the end. Following the completion of this first video, he spent a good portion of time, a few hours at least, learning everything he could about the classical double-slit experiment. When he thought he understood the mechanics of the experiment, or at least understood the mechanics as well as anyone might, there came a point when the behavior of the system simply baffled any attempts at understanding. He went back and watched the Nowak video again. On the second viewing, he felt less dismissive. He searched for additional information on Nowak's experiments and found a collection of scientific publications which detailed a number of procedures spanning thousands of test subjects over several years. He buried himself in the details, scribbling notes on hotel stationery until the tablet was exhausted and he had to run to the bedroom to get another. As he worked, a hypothesis began to grow in the pit of his mind like a red ember, neurons firing in sympathy, and his eyes began to dry. He brushed at his forehead periodically, and when he rested his fingertips upon the page, they left prints of oil. He read and wrote, wrote and read, until his bladder screamed and he begrudged the time required to go empty it, and when he came back to his chair, his hands nearly trembled for the time he had lost. His head began to float at the same time his surroundings began to brighten. The lights of nearby buildings extinguished, undetected by Giles, who tapped away on his wife's tablet to compose a parts list. He was concerned when he saw how the price tag grew, but then remembered that this was for Anagnoris's technologies and relaxed. If they were serious, and he had every reason to suspect they were, price would be no barrier. He worked until it made no sense to continue further, until four pads were filled completely with notes and diagrams, until his hand ached for a keyboard and his mind ached for a calculator app. He looked around for his phone so he could call Kevin and demand his laptop be returned, before he remembered they had his phone as well. He looked out on the city a few moments, wondering when it had been that the sun had returned, and when he saw from the clock that it was 6:30, he decided Kevin must be awake. He rung the front desk from the antique on the side table, had himself routed to Anagnorisis, and was stopped up short by their automated phone menu system. He took a few circuits through the menu selections until he found Kevin's extension and hit a brick wall when he was redirected to voicemail. He cursed, hung up, and then prepared to dial Reggie. He hesitated. He did not actually know Reggie's number, not by heart. He went to the other room and retrieved his wife's phone from the dock, unlocked the screen, and cast about in her address book until he found the number he desired. She had demanded Reggie's cell number some time ago when she found the process of getting Giles directly to be hit or miss. He dialed the number and waited an unacceptable period of time before Reggie picked up. He heard muffled fumbling, then a slurred voice.
Anna, what's going on? Are you guys okay? Is Giles all right?
It's me, Reggie.
Giles? What?
I'm calling from Anna's phone. They still have mine.
Oh. Right. What's going on?
I need Kevin's number. His cell number, Reggie.
Do you have any idea what time it is?
Reggie?
Hang on a minute. God damn it, Giles.
His voice trailed off as he set the phone down. Giles sat in the chair waiting, rapidly tapping his foot and blinking his burning eyes. There was a glare coming in through the window that made him want to draw the curtains, but he refused to step away from the table until Reggie returned, irrationally concluding that doing so would somehow impact Reggie's ability to respond. When he heard silence for longer than he thought was reasonable, he wondered if he should not hang up and dial again, but then detected the sound of a door closing somewhere far away, and then Reggie was back on the phone. He gave Giles the number and then asked what time it was in New York. Giles told him. Reggie said to wait another hour before blowing up Kevin's phone. Giles told him he would, hung up, and then dialed Kevin's number. Kevin answered much faster than Reggie, for which Giles felt a wave of blind gratitude. He wondered for a split second if he was somehow being disloyal, but then he heard the gentle, energetic voice of Kevin on the other end and allowed himself to forget the concern. There were only a few words of strained pleasantries before Giles could no longer restrain himself.
I need to get back into that lab, Kevin.
Ah, yes. Well, we're still going over that right now, Giles.
Have your guys found anything?
No. Actually, I had that on my list to do first thing this morning. Both the laptop and phone checked clean.
Okay. Giles sighed. No problem, then. Let me in there.
It's not that easy.
Well, why?
Now he heard Kevin sigh, and the sound of it carried a hesitance Giles did not like.
You've checked out, so now they're turning all attention to our own employees.
This is starting to heat up, Giles. There are protesters gathered out at the lab.
Protesters? What is it now?
They appear to be religious fundamentalists of some sort. Big flashy signs saying such things as only God can create life and the like. I saw a few verses quoted as well. There's a camera crew out there, obviously. It's not horrendous, yet. I think I only counted about 20 or so people out there. My guess is it's a local church that got bored waiting for bingo night to come around, but it doesn't look too hot on the news. You know how they do. Close-in shots so the crowd looks bigger.
Giles squeezed his eyes shut and drew a slow breath.
You mean to tell me they want to put a stop to this because of a handful of Bible thumpers?
Well, that is a part of it. The main issue is that the leak has not yet been identified, so everyone's really jumpy. We're getting this incident under control right now, but a lot of my colleagues wonder what point there is in continuing if someone just leaks out more information before we're ready. We'll just be right back in the pot. There's a bunch of attention from the media, which nobody likes, and Linnea's worried about moving forward until we have a plug. You may come to learn this about her if any kind of partnership develops out of this. The one thing Linnea hates above all else is the wrong kind of media attention.
Leaning over the desktop, Giles said, I think that's universal among executives.
Okay, I get it. And it doesn't matter, Kevin. You've got to get me in there.
You found something, Giles. Or you think you have.
What is it?
Giles began to explain, but Kevin stopped him about 3 minutes in.
How long will this take, Giles?
Well, you're a physicist, aren't you, Kevin? You're familiar with a double.
Yes, of course I am. I mean, how long will this take you to explain to an executive?
Giles gave it some thought.
Maybe a while.
Do you think you can get it into a PowerPoint by 2 o'clock?
Giles grunted, then blinked hard. He needed a good dash of water to the face.
That's part of why I called. I need my PC back so I can finish formulating the test setup.
I see. I can't promise anything, but I'll try to have it over in your hands by 10 o'clock. If I can, will you be able to get that presentation together?
I can, but I'd really rather...
Executives love PowerPoints, Giles. It's one of only 2 languages they understand.
Giles sat up in his chair.
What's the other?
Financial accounting. I'll get your PC back out to you. Get those slides together. I can't promise a meeting at 2 o'clock. It might happen a little later, but that should give me enough time to shuffle everyone's schedule around. Is this a good number to reach you at?
Send me back my phone and you can reach me on that.
Ah, right. You got it. I'll send both items over.
Thanks, Kevin. Seriously.
Just thanks. Make sure to use lots of pictures, Giles. Big, pretty ones with lots of colors. Animations, too, if you can find them.
Giles was halfway to the shower when Kevin disconnected.